Hello and welcome to Volume 143 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss how a fire at a lumber mill has affected the market. We'll discuss how tax proposals by the Biden administration could affect timber sales. We'll learn how you can tap into the trend of camping in style and comfort. And we'll also talk about how you can have it all, both pine and hardwood. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through ForesterSearch.com, or there's a link on this page. You'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Growing all pine trees in one stand is called a monoculture. Our first guest, John Willis, has written and studied about growing mixed stands of hardwood and pine. So welcome, John.
Thank you.
John, first tell us about the challenges you see in the traditional pine monoculture model.
Sure. Well, first off, everything is going to be based on your particular location. So what I'm going to say doesn't necessarily apply to every spot in the southeastern United States, but there are three big factors that I've seen that have really strained the traditional pine production model. One is simply a declining market for small diameter pines and hardwoods in some areas. We've had a decline in the workforce in terms of the logging capacity to take the woods to market. And what that's kind of conspired to do is increase the property size, the minimum property size on which folks are able to practice intensive pine silviculture.
Well, what opportunities do you see to rectify this in a mixed stand with both pine and hardwood within the same stand?
So in a mixed stand, there's a few different options that provide you some flexibility that may help in terms of your stand management. And one is just the attractiveness of your stand to a logger. And I'm talking about a situation where a logger could be on a quota at one particular mill, let's say a pine mill, for example, but he or she may be able to take logs to a hardwood facility. And so in that situation, if you have two comparable stands, one is a monoculture and one is a mixed stand, that mixed stand may have a bit more desirability in terms of its ability to be marketed to a logger. The second is management flexibility. If you're managing both pines and hardwoods in the same stand, as market conditions change, you may have the ability to alter your management to favor either pines or hardwoods, depending on what the forecasted outlook is for forest products. And the third is just the opportunity to combine wildlife opportunities with forestry. As lots of folks who I talk to, they're really into timber and they're really into wildlife. Those are really the two big things why they own the property. And I think you have the ability to really expand what you can do in terms of wildlife habitat by increasing the species diversity in the stand.
Are there places where mixed stand management are more successful than others?
Sure. I mean, obviously, on the economic flexibility side, you need to have both a pine and a hardwood market. So that's really a key part to all this. I think on mixed stand management could be really successful on some of the less productive sites where you cannot maximize either pine or hardwood productivity. And so the economics of intensive pine silviculture make less sense on those sites. So in those situations, it may be better to try something like mixed stand management. And from a personnel perspective, it's just what you want to do with your land. For the landowner who has multiple objectives, I think this could be a good situation.
All right. Well, thank you, John. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Our next guest can highlight how disruptions at a sawmill can affect prices locally. T.R. Clark can fill us in on a story that involves a lumber mill in Lafayette, Alabama, that suffered a devastating fire on April 22nd and the effects which reverberate from that fire. Welcome, T.R.
Hey, good to be here.
As a result of that fire at East Alabama Lumber Company, what effects do you see in the stumpage market in that area?
Well, I think it's a pretty hot topic right now that there is a real disconnect, and that this is off subject a little bit, but a real disconnect between finished lumber pricing and what stumpage prices are. But the one thing that drives good pricing is competition between mills in local markets. So obviously we've got a mill that has went down in our local market, and that decreases competition. That is not necessarily a good thing for stumpage prices.
Well, it's bad news for many people. And is it bad news across the board to timber sellers?
Maybe and maybe not. If you know the history of East Alabama Lumber Company in this region, they have a sister mill, Dudley Lumber Company, and they have not participated to a great extent in the open market for the last two or three years. They've been cutting on company land. Before the fire, they had just begun to participate in the market again, so we've been kind of without that mill participating for the last 2 years. And Dudley Lumber is going to start a second shift. So it appears to me that they're going to offset that production, at least temporarily, through a second shift and through Dudley. So we still have those folks participating in our market.
Okay. Modern sawmills have more strict diameter limits than they have in the past. How could this fire affect those diameter limits that you typically see?
Sure. Well, East Alabama and Dudley both have a 28-inch diameter limit for their whole tree processing. Their competitors in the area, which is immediately for Chambers County, is pretty much West Fraser and Opelika, and it's GP in Talladega. Both of those have very strict diameter limits. I believe it's 19 inches and 22. So with the fire, there is less market now for what I would call oversized timber.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about on the larger end of the stem. Is that where it's measured? The measurement is taken? Okay.
Yep, that's.
Well, how does a landowner adjust to this new reality in the marketplace?
Yes, you need to consider shorter rotation ages, and it may, traditionally this area has been two thins and grow a plantation to 35 to say 42 years old. When we had large dimension lumber type mills, the larger you could go to tree, the better. In this current situation, it is probably worth the landowner's consideration to go to a one-thin regime and grow their timber to 24 to 32 years old. That way you have maximum exposure to the market.
All right. That's good advice. Thank you very much for that. Appreciate that, TR. Dr. Yan-Shu Lee is a forester professor at the University of Georgia, who specializes in taxation. She can help us understand how the tax proposals by the Biden administration, described as making the rich pay their fair share, could affect forest owners. Hello, Yan-Shu.
Hi, this is Yan-Shu.
First, tell us what proposals are on the table that could affect forest landowners.
On April the 28th, President Biden has announced his American Families Plan, and in the plan, there are a few proposals that could affect American family forest landowners. And first one is he has proposed to increase the marginal capital gain tax rate from the current 20% to 39.6%. And when you combine with the current 2.3% net investment income tax, that makes the top capital gain tax rate increase from the current 23.8% to 43.4%. That's almost doubled. And that's the first one. The second one, he has proposed to tax unrealized gain, appreciate assets when a taxpayer dies, and then eliminates the step-up basis of that asset with a $1 million exemption and several exceptions. And additionally, he has proposed to tax the 1031 like-kind exchange with the capital gains over $500,000. Those are the major proposals that could affect family landowners.
Okay, so just to review, increasing increasing the capital gains rate from 22.8 to 43.4 is one. Disallowing a step-up basis at death, and then the 1031 limitations for over $500,000. What would the effect be if these proposals were passed by Congress?
Definitely, we need more details on the on those proposals. In its current form, most likely, most landowners will be protected by the income threshold and the exemptions. But definitely, some landowners could be affected adversely by those proposals. For example, the increase in capital gains tax rate could mean a significant increase in tax for some landowners when they have a large timber sale. And if they have other source of income that easily push them over the $1 million household income per year threshold. Second, taxing the unrealized gain at death and the eliminating the step-up basis could have a significant impact on some landowners. As we know, trees grow over time, and timberland price appreciate a lot in the past decade. So it means heirs could pay a significant amount of tax when they receive the property from their parents.
And the 1031.
You know, 1031 is a very important tax strategy for many small business and private landowners to sell and buy timber property and timberland property. So if there is a limitation on this, that could affect how they defer the gain and how they buy and sell the timber property.
How do you, how can a landowner take steps to lessen the burden of taxation if these proposals pass?
Definitely, we need more details, but first there's no need to panic because, as I said, most landowners could be protected by the income threshold and the exemption. But if you have plans for timber harvest in the next couple of years, maybe it's a good time for you to talk to your consulting foresters and tax advisors to see if there's any possibility to sell them now. And but if your timber is not ready to sell, then just hold it. And there's no need to sell it just for this proposal right now. But definitely, you need to watch closely on the development of the tax proposal and stay engaged in the discussion.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Yanshu. We appreciate that.
Thanks.
Some folks love to rough it outdoors to test how well they can react to deprivation, but others prefer to camp in a comfortable environment where enjoyment is paramount. A company called Tenter provides the latter method of camping in comfort and even style. Jay Sears with Tenter can help us with this. Hello, Jay.
Hi, Hayes. How are you?
For someone that's not familiar with Tenter, tell us what it does.
Tenter is, you could think of it as an Airbnb for camping. So Tenter, and it's spelled T-E-N-T with two R's on the end. On one side, we market to people that want to be outdoors through a mobile application, a website, and through syndicating our campsite listings through travel sites like Expedia and Booking.com. And on the other side of the business, we work with public and private landowners to put down what we call our Tenter signature site. So this is what you talked about in terms of going in style and comfort. This is a 10 by 16 semi-permanent platform with a 10 by 12 canvas wall tent. And it comes with all the accoutrements to make you comfortable. A queen memory foam mattress, side tables. Outside, you're going to find Adirondack chairs, a fire pit. It's really intended to be a turnkey experience for campers. The company now is operating in over 40 states with over 1,000 campsites. And we like to say we have over 15,000 happy campers who have spent the night under the stars with us.
Well, you've talked a little bit about the camper end, but how do you work with the landowner that's providing the service?
So with private landowners, Tenter's looking for landowners that want to make land available to our campers. In terms of the most typical arrangement, the landowner pays a one-time license fee of $6,500 for us to come on a turnkey basis, install this Tenter signature site, and then the landowner, we go market that site out to our campers, as I described, and the landowner retains 80% of the booking revenue. Typically, and it ranges, revenue for a single signature site might be between $5,000 and $10,000 each year. And a typical reservation fee, if people want to do back-of-the-envelope math, is $125 a night, but that can vary depending on the particular situation.
How could a landowner evaluate whether Tenter is going to be the right fit for them?
Yeah, so here's a very kind of quick check boxes a landowner could think about. First, are they within 1 or 2 hours of a metropolitan area? So driving distance, maybe near Atlanta or Chattanooga or Birmingham or Mobile. Two, is there a secluded area for each of these Tenter signature sites you'd think about installing? So we don't club them together. Part of the experience is that it is secluded. Three, is there front country access? So can the camper drive up or drive near the location? And four, are there unique features to the site? So is there water access? Maybe there's a river, a lake. What type of activities are there? Hiking, fishing, hunting, birding, swimming, canoeing. And are there experiences you can offer? This is also important because it's another income-generating opportunity. So it might be activities that are close to the land. So, by example, we have an alpaca farm that has a Tenter signature site, and they offer kind of a look at the farm operations. So what's the equivalent for where you are? Could you offer kayak rentals or stand-up paddleboard rentals if you're on a lake or a river or other things like that? And we're, of course, very happy to talk to folks, to do a short call and just see if the fit is right between the landowner and Tenter.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jay. It's very interesting. We appreciate your offering that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to John Willis, T.R. Clark, Yanshu Lee, and Jay Sears. I found out that I was rich when I opened my mailbox. And that's when I saw an envelope that on the outside told me that I was more wealthy than I thought. I hurriedly opened the envelope to find that I could obtain this wealth by mortgaging my house. Most people are not forest owners. They know little about trying to manage forest land or trying to pass down land to their family. So it's hard for many to identify with the concerns of forest owners about capital gains, the stepped-up basis, and 1031 exchanges. Hopefully in the future, there will be more forest owners, more people with a keen interest in the long-term project of forest ownership, more people interested in protecting land from others whose ideas of land ownership are not their own. We live in a time when what it means to be a forest owner is being decided for you rather than by you. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.